Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
It's December 23rd. We're doing it on a Tuesday this week. Hi, this is John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast. It's 2:39 in the afternoon. Listen for me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
Hey, it's Brandon Pope, award-winning multimedia journalist and author of the Screening Room Film and TV Newsletter Substack.
I'm Steve Bertrand. I'm currently a minister without portfolio, but I'm overcoming 40 years at WGN Radio News, most of them as a news anchor, with John Williams.
I'm Eric Zorn, who, like Steve Bertrand, is an original member of the Mincing Rascals podcast panel back when dinosaurs walked the earth. We were all together, and I'm really happy that Steve is back. I write the Picayune Sentinel Substack newsletter in my semi-retirement.
Yeah, the OGs are here. Am I using that correctly? Is that how the cool kids say it?
That's what they say. Yeah.
Brandon is one of the cool kids, so that's I'd go with that.
OGs or unks. They like to say unks. Unks.
What does that mean? Is that pronouncing OG?
Like unks? Uncle.
Uncle. Like, yeah. Isn't unk a little bit pejorative, like you're an old man, a little bit out of it?
Some people take it.
Are you looking at the Zoom screen, Eric? I mean, what part of that is not?
I had a young mentee of mine call me unk for the first time, and I immediately stopped him. I was like, wait, we can't do that. I'm 33. I'm not unk territory yet. We gotta hold the line there.
I remember.
All right, where is unk territory then, Brandon, if that's what
when you cross the line into unkdom?
I think once you're 40, I say 40 and up, you start 40. To get unk territory.
Okay, then, nephew.
Okay. Well, let's welcome back to the Mincing Rascals, Steve Bertrand, our longtime newsman at WGN Radio, has retired from the station, you may well know, but not his travel business, SteveBertrandTravel.com. And so, unshackled from the opinion-neutral arena of WGN Radio News, he's been freed to offer his newsworthy opinions on some of the big stories of the day. So, Steve, good to see you back on the pod. Thank you.
Yeah, it's good to be back. And honestly, it was it's hard to describe, but the need for objectivity that drove me out. I just feel like this is no time to be objective. And so it kind of had an impact on when I decided to leave the anchor chair.
I don't know what no time to be objective means.
Well, I mean, I was, you know, sitting there and to be objective, it's up to you and Eric and Brandon to maybe write opinions. But I basically was presenting a lot of what the Trump administration was saying as if it could be fact when it clearly wasn't or couldn't be. And I just kind of felt like I was lending them what little objectivity I had left.
But you would tag a story if it was something the president said wasn't true, like the unemployment isn't that, or if there was something the president or Carolyn Leavitt said that wasn't true, if you played that soundbite, you would then say, would you not? However, you would have something that corrected the record, no?
Sometimes, but, you know, to do that, I'd have to be uber confident of it and, you know, hope to have examples of it. And it's just not the same.
And so the question becomes then, should I say what the president said since I don't think it's true? Or should I say what the president said because the president said it, and then it's up to the people to do the deeper dive?
Well, let's go back to when the Border Patrol came to Chicago and the first person, the man they shot to death in one of the suburbs. And that day they came out, Border Patrol or ICE or the Trump administration, and said that a border agent was, I think, seriously injured. Two were seriously injured. That the man drove away and tried to run over the border agents.
Yeah.
And when that statement came across into the newsroom, it's like, well, that sounds like a tragic situation. It's very likely that's what happened. The guy got scared and drove away. And now we have an agent seriously injured. So I did that story. And then weeks later, the video from the local police comes out and shows that Border Patrol agent saying it was no big deal. He was fine. I don't want to participate in that kind of crap anymore.
The words did not match what we were able to see.
Ever.
Yeah.
Ever. I mean, the other one about the woman, she sideswiped an ICE vehicle when we saw the video. It was ICE that swiped her. And I wasn't going to do it anymore.
You weren't on the podcast last week, but Eric and I were talking. Was it on the pod or on the radio, Eric, about whether or not the networks should broadcast the president's address last Wednesday? And Eric said, absolutely not, without the benefit of a transcript in advance. Eric offered that it's going to be just a campaign commercial full of lies and that you shouldn't spread that. It's not like this is post 9/11 and we need to hear from the president about what's happened and what our response is going to be. It's just him trying to adjust the record. And I quite disagreed with Eric on that. Eric, am I remembering that story correctly?
I think you are, because I think you'll have to now admit that I was right.
I did end up watching it the next day. I didn't want to ruin a perfectly good Wednesday night, but I watched it the next morning. You're closer to being correct on that than I was. But I also feel that the right decision was to put it on the radio and put it on TV. There was a lot of fallout from that speech, you recall.
You're asking me to concede a point here? I mean, what I'm saying is that it was that in previous administrations, the White House communications team asks the networks for a block of time, and they tell them why, and the networks say yes or no. And they have said no. In the past, they said no to Obama. They said no to Biden at times when he wanted to speak about topics. Why they didn't say no to Trump, I think it was a business decision. I think they were afraid of him. It was very clear that there was not a moment that he needed. Like if we had begun bombing Venezuela, okay, then he needs to go on the air and explain that as much as he possibly could. But there was nothing. He was simply trying to recover or bring his poll numbers back up, because his poll numbers were cratering. And they
you
still
saw
are,
his,
are,
you remember his first sentence. Hello, he said, good evening. I inherited a mess and now I'm fixing it. I mean, so
right.
that laid the foundation for what he was about
right.
to do.
Which was a lie. He did not inherit a mess. He inherited an inflation rate that's exactly what it is now. He inherited a GDP that was a little bit better than it is now. I mean, he's talking about from the peak of the COVID inflation in Biden during 2022, which is undeniable and can easily be second-guessed, to what it was what he inherited. If he had just come into the White House and done nothing, things would be better than they are now. So he didn't inherit a mess. He was handed one of the best economies in the world at that time. Now, I know that the people say, well, what about all the inflation under Biden? Yeah, that's true. What about COVID and how Trump failed to address it early on and how it got out of control? That's also true. But the fact that he started with a lie, then saying that the inflation was the worst that it had been in 48 years, not true. Some say he said that it was the worst inflation in the history of the country, which is just wildly not true. There's, you know, both world wars ended up with inflation rates closer to 20 than 9.
But I just don't think you were giving credit to people to discern the fact from fiction. In at least
because they haven't earned it, John. The people haven't earned it, the credit to be able to discern.
The people haven't earned it. What do you mean by that?
That was another part of this whole thing. It's like you could say, you know, you could put something in the news that was just absolutely outrageous and unbelievable, but his people still believed it to be true. I don't think the American people have shown a discernment level that's necessary for a successful democracy.
That is so paternalistic.
Maybe it is.
Brandon, where are you on this? You are not only have been a newsman for much of your career, but the president of a news organization, the Black Journalists of Chicago.
Ooh, it's loaded. I hear what Steve is saying. People have a tough time deciphering fact from fiction. Trump has risen to power largely off of just saying things that aren't true and people just rolling with it, right? I do wonder what the litmus test is for networks to carry the messages. We know they've denied Barack Obama to do the same thing before, George W. Bush to do the same thing before, because they would deem their messages too political. They did deny Trump the opportunity to have slides, a slideshow.
Fox showed them.
Fox ended up showing them, yeah, but hey, Fox News for you. that's not too surprising. But I do think once it's this constant stress test the media has to face in how much you're able to cover Trump while also actively holding him accountable for the lies he constantly tells. Almost everything he says, usually there's a lie involved at some point. But it's like nearly impossible to fact check all that in real time, right? but he's also the president of the United States. It's a conundrum that I think media still has not figured out how to do or how to handle. But I do think some of the public and some of the Trump voting public is starting to wise up a little bit, maybe a little too late, but it seems to finally be little cracks in the armor a little bit.
So let's go back to maybe be the 90s, and I think this is an interesting example in the middle when George II addressed, and I can remember where I was. I was driving, and it was at the time when stem cell research was a major topic, and George W. asked for network time to explain his position on stem cell research. That wasn't, you know, the U.S. is invading, or it wasn't the economy's better under me than ever, sort of in the middle. And I think that was a good use of broadcast time because it was a difficult issue and he made his case one way or the other for it. So that's sort of in the middle, and I think that's where it works. But, you know, it's been made easier, too, since there are so many news outlets and ways to get it. I mean, it used to be if it was the big three or four or whatever, the public wouldn't have a chance to see this address somewhere else. Now they do. So I think the networks are a little more justified in not giving up the time all the time.
There's no denying that point. I'll grant you that. Talk about this, guys. CBS spiked a 60 Minutes story on Sunday, and that was about the notorious Cicot prison in El Salvador. The U.S. has been sending Venezuelan migrants there, and 60 Minutes had a story about that ready to go that the administration declined to comment on. The segment had been promoted by the network, but at the last minute, CBS News editor-in-chief Barry Weiss pulled it. She said it wasn't ready. One last thing, however. The story did somehow become available online in Canada, and now everyone can see it, although I was clicking around for it today, and I wasn't able to find it. Eric, you've watched the episode via that Canadian link, right?
It was broadcast quality when I saw, and I posted it to Picayune Sentinel. I haven't checked in the last few minutes. I've warned people that it could be taken down at any minute, and maybe I'll do that while we're talking here, see if it's been taken down off my site. But yeah, it's one of the usual 13-minute segments from 60 Minutes. Seemed very thoroughly reported. They asked the administration and several of the departments in the administration for comment, and they refused comment. And essentially what had been happening is that they were taking these Venezuelan migrants, undocumented people who are either undocumented or their asylum cases hadn't been heard yet, putting them on airplanes and sending them to one of the worst prisons in the world. And they showed footage from those prisons that they had. The El Salvador is conspicuously proud of this prison, and so they let social media people and media people in all the time to look at what's going on there. It's horrifying, but they're proud of it. And CBS interviewed some of the people who'd been there. And, you know, was it something brand new? Barry Weiss was arguing that this didn't really advance the ball much. And my contention for that is it might not be all that new to people who are really paying attention, but there are a lot of people who really don't pay attention to the news in depth, except when they're watching a show like 60 Minutes that they've come to trust over the last, whatever it is, 50, 60 years, however long it's been on the air. And so this was an important moment to get this information, this story out in front of a large audience. Barry Weiss, the new CEO or editor-in-chief of CBS News, okayed the segment back at the end of last week and then began expressing some doubts on Saturday morning, and finally on Sunday afternoon, just a couple hours before it aired, she pulled the plug on it. And her excuse was that they hadn't talked, didn't have on camera an administration source defending what's going on there. What's going on to these prisoners, the extrajudicial punishment they were inflicting on these people. So Barry Weiss said they didn't have that, so they couldn't run the piece. But in fact, the reporters and the 60 Minutes staff had repeatedly asked for comment and not gotten it. And so what Barry Weiss, in effect, did was she allowed the administration to kill the story. Because there's no question in my mind that she was at least in contact, not in contact, but at least had in mind how the White House was going to react. And she seems to be the tool for the White House when it comes to things like this. Now, she's in place because she's going to make sure that the network is not too liberal. So she yanks it, basically giving the White House the ability to kill a story by not commenting on it, which is a trick that every one of us knows. This is how sources who are embarrassed, who don't have a really good answer, they hope to kill stories by not commenting. This happens all the time. They think, well, if I don't say anything, then they can't run a story. Not true. Never been true until right now, I guess. And so that's why people at 60 Minutes are so upset. This thing was approved. It had gone through the lawyers. It had been through many layers of review. And Barry Weiss yanked it for a wholly bogus reason. If they want to follow up, if they want to run that piece and then follow up with the administration's response, they're free to do that. I'm guessing the administration is not going to offer any comment and just hope the story goes away.
And if you're listening and you doubt what Eric's saying, just for the next 48 hours when you're listening to a newscast or watching a newscast, count how many times you hear the reporter say such and such was not available for comment, or we did not hear a comment from such and such. Those stories run all the time.
Yeah. And they were referred to El Salvador for many questions they had in the 60 Minutes piece. If you go back and watch it, which was a great piece by Sharon Alfonsi, who I have great respect for. Another reason why CBS News staffers are upset, and I happen to be friends with a lot of great people at CBS News, is because Barry Weiss is unqualified for the job she has. She has never had a job in television news. She's never worked in television news. So how are you going to be editor-in-chief of a television news platform? And so many of these things that we're running into with this particular story show just at minimum a lack of experience with what you're dealing with here. Not showing up to screenings of the actual presentation of the actual story. There were allegedly, what, five different screenings that happened, and she missed every single one of them. She could have waited 11 days before the story even ran. She refused to. She finally engaged on Thursday, made suggestions that the staff did incorporate, according to the New York Times.
Did or didn't incorporate?
They did incorporate them, according to the New York Times. They did.
Yeah.
But then she had new ones on Friday. And the thing with TV news is, like, it's not like with print where you can just call somebody up and get a quote. With 60 Minutes, you got to set up lighting, equipment, find a place to film, have release forms. So that's why you have the deadlines you do for people to respond and give comment, because you can't just scrap something and rush around and do that so easily. In text, you can just change some copy. It takes a lot more for 60 Minutes. So the whole thing to me just paints a picture of someone who at minimum and at best is in over her head, but at worst is looking to kill stories for the Trump administration. And so it's sad to see. I grew up watching CBS 60 Minutes with my grandma. Part of the reason why I got into journalism is because of watching 60 Minutes. And to see it done this way is devastating, not just for CBS News or for journalism, but mm-hmm. for democracy overall. The storytelling that comes out of 60 Minutes for decades has been groundbreaking, has been law-changing, and has been so key to the fabric of our country. And now it's under its greatest threat ever.
Eric says that she's there to make sure that the broadcasts aren't too liberal. But at the end of the day, they want these broadcasts to be profitable, successful, and viewed. Is this such a stupid move by Barry Weiss or CBS that it's actually going to hurt them? Like, I don't think I was going to watch the C-Cut episode. I don't normally even segment. I don't normally watch 60 Minutes. Now I really want to watch it. Maybe that'll get him some eyeballs this one time. But now if I think about CBS or if I think about 60 Minutes, I'm going to think that they are reflecting a bias that they shouldn't reflect any bias. They should just be telling me the story. I mean, ultimately, this hurts the network. It hurts the show. It's damaging to their brand.
Absolutely. Barry Weiss is a conservative opinion journalist. So the idea that she would come in and make CBS News more objective, which is already, when you talk about the broadcast news stations, CBS is for the longest, is considered to be the most down the middle, the most
I thought cutter, so. But you don't want to be the story either. You want to be the teller of the story. Now that now CBS's yeah, objectivity depends. Is the story.
It depends on who the alternate victim or of the story is. If it's Trump in your CBS, you might want to take that lump because he's, you know, a vindictive president.
But the sales already right, went through. I mean, what are they going to do now?
I don't know. But I mean,
Their licenses?
Well, he's threatened that. I mean, he has threatened to pull the licenses of organizations that are too critical of him. And not to get too much into this, but that was the other reason why I thought it was time for me to go, was the idea of this $16 million settlement from CBS for a nonsensical lawsuit done not for the freedom of the press, but for the bottom line of the ledger. I was going to retire within a year anyway, and I don't want to think it's too much about me, but my decision came when Jimmy Kimmel was knocked off the air for business reasons. And the company that owns the station I used to work for was involved in that. I don't want to single them out at all, because it's an industry-wide movement now to where people in other businesses, and they're looking more toward not losing money or making money than they are standing up for freedom of expression. And that's just where we are. And I think that's why CBS would rather take its lumps on their own noggin than have them inflicted by the White House.
It's very interesting. This is an example, I think, of what's called the Streisand effect. You guys aware of that? And the Streisand effect refers to an incident, I don't know how long ago, when Barbara Streisand threatened to sue a small publication for publishing a picture of her house. And this lawsuit caused the internet to go into an uproar, and everybody on the internet shared pictures of Barbara Streisand's house, meaning that if she had just kept her yap shut and let this picture run on some obscure website, things would be fine. I think in this case, if Barry Weiss had just said, well, you know what, we'll follow up on this if the administration has more comment, but let's run this story, it would not have made half the ripple that it's made. I just checked on the link on my Substack, which is ericzorn.substack.com. There is a link to the video, a site that has the video, and it's still there at this moment. I urge people to watch it, and I hope that more people end up watching this than any 60-minute segment in the last 25 years, because it's an important segment, and CBS deserves to be shamed for it.
I wonder what's going to happen next then. Will the administration stay mum, hoping that the story doesn't get broadcast in the U.S., or will they make a comment and then 60 Minutes will incorporate that denial or context, and then it will be broadcast? Do you think there's more pressure on them to run a story now that they don't want to run than there would have been if they had just run the damn thing and we wouldn't be sitting here talking about it?
Absolutely. I think it's absolutely the case that there's going to be pressure on the network. They are going to have to come through with this, their reputation is already in shambles, and it's going to be worse after this. They have really stepped in it, and they have to run the piece in some form, I think. I mean, Barry Weiss could continue to say it's not ready, and then hope that because of all the new things that Donald Trump has been doing all the time, you know, naming things after him, putting his name on the Kennedy Center and all that people get sort of inured to all this nonsense, and finally they just have moved on to the next outrage about whether we're going to attack, I guess, attacking Greenland is now back in the picture. And
no, buying Greenland. We're not going to attack Greenland, are we?
Oh, no. Well, we could. Why don't we just attack it? There are not that many people there, right?
What would be cheaper, do you think, to buy it or attack it?
Take it by force or offer them the kind of money that we did to Russia when we bought Alaska, say, something like
Brandon,
that.
Brandon, do you think CBS is going to end up running this story?
Yeah, because of public pressure. I think it's going to be altered. I think there's going to be things that added. The original thing we just saw that aired in Canada, that's not going to be what we're going to see in America.
Yeah, but if they only tacked on there, the administration saying something, it would still be a pretty damning or enlightening piece, right? It would still shine a light on what we're doing. And then they can say, well, these are the worst of the worst. We've got to get them out of the country. I can live with that. Let them say that if they want.
Well, I mean, the thing is, we have heard Carolyn Leavitt talk about what she thinks is the reason for this. And she'll talk about how these are rapists and gang members and drug dealers and, you know.
She had a long laundry list, yeah.
She had a long laundry list of them. But the truth is, and the piece makes this case definitively, which is a very, very small percentage of the people who they have rounded up and sent to this incredibly brutal prison are not guilty, have not been found guilty of any crimes. And even some of these suspected drug dealers and gang members, they haven't been guilty of any crimes. They talk about how, in the piece, they talk about how just having a tattoo can put somebody in prison. Not necessarily even a gang identified tattoo can put a Venezuelan in prison. Apparently, also Barry Weiss objected to the fact that they were using the term Venezuelan migrants instead of illegal immigrants.
Well,
illegal immigrants is a loaded term, and one that I think is best avoided in a neutral
But did they address that, Eric? That is, these weren't U.S. citizens that were sent down there, correct? And they were people without proper documentation, correct? So that's a crime unto itself. That's a reason for expulsion, according to the administration. And they are getting away with it. There's no court ruling or congressional act that keeps them from doing that. So you can expel people without proper documentation, and they're finding any way they choose fit.
It's Carol Levitt back several months ago who said that one of the people they arrested, one of the more infamous cases early on, he was picked up in part because he was wearing, a Bulls jacket or Bulls t-shirt, or and gang members wore the Bulls shirts or socks. I don't remember.
Yeah, right. I know what you're talking about.
That was Enrico Garcia, right?
Yeah.
And they send him off to his prison. The thing is, if you want to deport people, that is one thing. I don't think it's necessary in all these cases. But if you want to deport them, fine. But they're sending them to not just a prison, but one of the worst prisons in the world. On what basis? This is what I just don't understand. You send someone, a Venezuelan person, to El Salvador. El Salvador has no jurisdiction over what a Venezuelan person did in the United States or Venezuela. You can't just lock somebody up without a trial. But apparently we're fine with that, just like we're fine with blowing boats out of the water on basically no evidence right now.
By the way, guys, I'm going to El Salvador in about 5 weeks, so I'll see if they'll let me in. Maybe I can do a story for the Mincing Rascals.
You are doing that. You travel down there with a charitable group to provide eyeglasses, right, Steve? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I could get in.
Another big story in Chicago this week. The Bears are threatening to go to Northwest Indiana. The team isn't getting any love from state lawmakers. The team says all they're asking for is infrastructural help that Illinois would give any other business. And the price tag on that for a new stadium in Arlington Heights would be around $800 million. Absent a bill to finance this, they're now looking at the Hoosier State. Brandon, how seriously should we take the possibility that the Bears will go to Northwest Indiana?
I think we should take it seriously. They've threatened this in the past, and I think those were more empty than they are now. I think the reason you should take it seriously right now is because it appears that the Illinois State House is not going to move. It's not going to budge on this. They said it's flat out, and every lawmaker I've talked to has told me similar. 2026, the Bears ain't getting nothing toward any sort of project, right? It's just the way it is.
Sure,
if the Bears want to get started on this now, and they want to get started.
Yeah, but you laughed at that like you're a Packer fan, Brandon.
Not at all. Look, that's a wild one. I would never try to say I'm a Packer fan. But what I'm mostly saying is this. If Indiana is going to be willing to offer the kickbacks and the financial support that Illinois won't, and you were to build, say, in Hammond, Indiana, which is like right outside the city, look, the New York Giants and Jets play in New Jersey. The Washington Commanders play in Virginia. It wouldn't be out of the question, because the reality is this. While people are understandably not wanting to give rich people any sort of kickbacks, when we talk about owners of NFL franchises, the McCaskies are not like the owners of the Rams or the Raiders.
Cowboys.
They do not have the money to spend for a $1 billion stadium. And so Kevin Warren here, I feel like, is being scapegoated a little bit, because at the end of the day, the Bears don't got the money. The state's not going to give you the money. So what are you going to do when you were brought there, literally hired to build a stadium? You go to Indiana and do it. If they're going to offer the money, they're going to do it. And Kansas City, what the Chiefs have going on right now.
They're just crossing the state line.
Yeah.
Going from Missouri to Kansas and all the money that Kansas is giving to the Chiefs just to do that. I mean, that's your test case right there. And that's pretty much what I think Indiana is going to try to model as well.
The difference, though, is that Kansas doesn't have another NFL team and Indiana does. And John, I know you were talking about that this week, but the NFL gives the sort of home team some say over who else comes across their border, right? So I don't know if Indianapolis could spike it, but they could certainly discourage it.
And what they're looking for in Arlington Heights is they're looking for property tax breaks, significant property tax breaks. I think that the state is willing to do the basic infrastructure matters around the proposed project there. And that's kind of common with all these major developments, which is, okay, you're going to build a big factory here. We'll put in the curb cuts and so on. We will help with the infrastructure. And that's good economic sense, for a lot of these projects. Will Indiana want to give those property tax breaks? Do they have a parcel of land there that's not, a toxic cleanup site? I don't know. It will be crazy Kaplan's Dome Stadium down there across the border. I'm not sure who's going to sponsor, but Indiana could put it together. The question then for us as those who Brandon, do you go to Bears games?
Not a lot. I mean,
a lot. Okay, I haven't been in 25 years. I haven't been to New Soldier Field. That's how long it's been since I've been there. So it's a TV show for me. And if it's being filmed in Northwest Indiana or Arlington Heights or down on the lakefront, it doesn't really matter to me. The games themselves are what draws me. And, of the 67,000 people, at least 10 times that many are watching it at home.
If they were to go to Indiana, they would actually be staying closer to Soldier Field than if they go to Arlington Heights.
Yeah, I've thought about that. That is commute, but and I don't know that this matters that much either, Steve. But the commute would be unpleasant for much of Chicago. You got to take the Skyway or 80-94, whatever it is that's going south of that, and that's a mess. On a Saturday in the summer, imagine a Bears game.
That South Shore train going to get kind of packed. That's for sure. Look, I think at the end of the day, the Bears, the way they view this is they have to leave. They have to move. They have to get something different because they have the smallest NFL stadium in the country. They have the worst home field advantage. You talk to opposing NFL teams, they love playing in Chicago. They're not scared. There's no sound issue. They hear all their calls and plays. The Bears are losing money every day that they're stuck in Soldier Field. Yeah. So and they don't own Soldier Field. So that's the other problem too. So from their perspective, they have to leave.
And this is all their fault, right? I mean, it was a quarter century ago, they decided they were going to plop a seating bowl inside the colonnades of Soldier Field, not put a dome on it, and now, but before the place is even starting to show much age, they're saying, oh, it's not good enough. We wanted you to build us a new stadium. But they still owe. What, how much should they owe?
$450
million? I mean hundreds of millions of dollars they still owe on the project that they screwed up 25 years ago. And this is not hindsight speaking. I wrote columns back then saying this is a really bad idea. Don't build this. Don't do this. It's ugly and it's not going to last because you got to have an indoor. We could have had the NCAA Final Four here. They built a proper stadium. We could have had a Super Bowl or two here. Tractor pulls and conventions that it otherwise couldn't have made here. It was just a really bad decision by the mayor, Mayor Daley at the time, by the park district, by the Bears. Everybody messed up, and now they want state money, they want taxpayers to help them clean up their own mistake. And that's why I have no sympathy for them.
When they go to Indiana, Eric, and they have their first tractor pull, I want to go with you.
All right, we're there. We've got front row seats.
Have you ever been to a tractor pull?
I have not, but I have watched some on TV. And
I've done play-by-play of tractor pulls, and they are spectacular. And here's how you do play-by-play of a tractor pull. Here comes the tractor, and it's stopped. That's play-by-play of a tractor pull.
Hindsight's 20/20, right? But there was a time that we had a mayor named Lori Lightfoot who proposed adding a dome to Soldier Field, increasing the seating to 70,000, adding suites. It was going to be a $2.2 billion project, but it's looking a lot better right now than going to Arlington Heights or Hammond. Who says no at this point to Lori Lightfoot's plan from 2022?
She's also the one that said the Bears ought to try and beat the Packers before they ask for any assistance.
They did it.
It's time.
Yeah. No kidding. Well, it's time. But doesn't that, guys, make the timing of this? And I guess the Bears didn't control it. I believe the Tribune had a story earlier this week that it was going to come out that they were looking at Northwest Indiana. So as to manage that message, they put out that three-page memo that said that there's not sufficient urgency, was the word they used, in Springfield. They've been working on this for years, and it's not going anywhere, so they've got to go ahead and look at it. But the timing could not have been worse, right? The one time the city really is united behind the Bears, and they have these miraculous, most exciting games in memory, and now all we're doing is taking pot shots at the ownership or management of the team. What a PR disaster for the Bears.
When the Bears are doing well, then that gives the Bear organization a little more leverage, right? Then people are like, oh, we love the Bears that are in town. I mean, if the Bears were 2-12 right now, or whatever they're
But that's not what people are saying. They're not saying, oh, we love the Bears, don't do this. And they're saying, you idiots, how dare you think about going to Indiana? Now maybe I'm missing the point, Eric. You're telling me, though, that they've got more leverage with their winning season, right?
That's what I'm positing, yeah.
You know, if you're gonna go out and ask for more of the time to do it is when things are going well, and that they do have the leverage now. I mean, this is I think according to the playbook, when you would do it, I don't know that it's gonna I doubt that it's gonna work, but yeah, I understand why the timing to me makes more sense than it does.
Do they lose any fans? I mean, does it hurt them in the long run, right? Like, so now the Kansas City Chiefs are in Kansas instead of Missouri. Folks are still gonna go. So Brandon,
Bears fans are happiest. They're happiest when they're pissed off. So why not? Right, Brandon, am I right? Why
Indiana
not give them more?
Feels different, though. And I know half the teams in the NFL aren't playing in their namesake cities, but it feels different. Arlington Heights, we can get our head around. Indiana, it seems a million miles away. I mean, it just feels different, doesn't it? Doesn't it sound different to you? Doesn't it make it sound like Chicago is such a sad sack city that we got to carry our lunch to Indiana to have them help us with it? And I think people, for some reason, are like resistant to the notion, much more so of Indiana than they are Arlington Heights, even if it's closer.
That's because the way Chicagoans feel about Indiana is the way New Yorkers feel about New Jersey. There's always going to be this is like, ugh.
And Indiana's always dumping on us. I mean, you know, they're saying, hey, counties in southern Illinois, come on over. You don't need to be in lousy Illinois. Come over here where the taxes are less and you'll get more services. That's a pie in the sky. But, I mean, there's this sort of animosity. That's a very red state. Chicago is one of the bluest cities in the country. And nobody's talked about that. But I'm trying to put my finger on the resistance to going to Northwest Indiana. But there's something more than the state line there. It feels different. If you've been listening to radio or reading social media posts, I'm sure you guys have. You know the fans are outraged by this idea.
It's cultural, but at the end of the day, they still going to be fans. Like, people love outrage. Like, Steve said it great. I've never encountered so much negativity in a fan base that's winning games.
Right.
I have the Chicago Bears, and I'm a Browns fan, so I understand negativity. I understand losing. The negativity fans have around this team is mind-blowing to me.
Well, they've only been good the last 4 weeks.
No, but still, it doesn't matter. I mean, we had a coworker, and this was going back a long time, John, but after they won the Super Bowl, he said, yeah, they really didn't play that well. Right? So, I mean, and you know, the other thing, and I don't know how much there is to make of this, but part of this is speaking to the north and northwest suburban bias of this media market. I mean, if you live in Frankfort, Illinois, or if you live in Matteson, Illinois, Indiana, not Matteson more than Frankfort, Indiana's part of your ecosystem already. I mean, it might seem like it's, far away in a foreign land to you, but not to a lot of people who live in this market.
That's an interesting point, because all the TV news anchors, they don't live in Orland Park. They don't live in the south suburbs. They sure don't live in Indiana. I'll bet 90% of the people that talk on TV in this town live in the affluent suburbs or on the northwest side of the city, if that's what you're pointing out, Steve.
It is, yeah, it is.
Yeah. Speaking of sports, Paul Sullivan wrote in the Tribune today about Matt Shaw, the Cubs' handsome third baseman. Shaw, you may recall, missed a game this season to attend the memorial service for Charlie Kirk. Kirk was assassinated in Utah in September, and now Shaw appeared at the Turning Point USA event on Friday. Shaw played good defense for the Cubs this season, his rookie year, but he only hit .226. He went 2-for-17 in the playoffs. Is it a bad idea for Shaw to expose himself at the Turning Point USA event, not the memorial service for his friend, I guess, Charlie Kirk? Evidently they were close enough that he felt a personal connection and wanted to go there. The team supported him in that decision, at least publicly. So off he goes at a time when maybe we're trying to tune this team up for the playoffs. Off he goes and misses a day or two. But that was one thing. This Turning Point USA event was another. It was a political thing. It was a lot of infighting by the Republicans and maybe the vice president's attempt to position himself as the front runner in the next presidential election. Anyway, there is good old Matt Shaw. Does he deserve maybe some praise for the courage of his convictions? These are his politics or these are his religious views. While he might be criticized for it, he's going to stand up for what he believes in. Or would you criticize him for dipping his toe into those waters at all? I just wonder what you guys thought about that. I thought Sullivan had an interesting piece.
My inclination, my instinct is to be fine with Steve Kerr or Greg Popovich in the NBA when they're espousing views that I agree with.
How about it?
And
this is so
and then
true.
when an athlete expresses, you like Travis Kelce, or not Travis Kelce, who's the kicker? Butker on Kansas City, or now Shaw expresses views that I don't agree with, to say, well, shut up and play your sport. and the thing is, I admit to this, and also I know that a lot of people on the right do this with musicians and actors. They say, you know, yeah, shut up and act. And then when they find a Kid Rock or someone like that, they'll say, oh, but he's worthy of veneration. This is like a human, this is human nature. So I like, if I can step back, I could say that it's probably a bad idea for Shaw to do this because half the fan base is going to be really offended by what he says. The same thing, though, is true of Popovich and Kerr and those other athletes who stand out, that if you want to use your platform for something like that that's controversial, that's certainly your right, and I hope the team doesn't stand in that person's way. As a career move, as an effort to, you know, like have your jersey be worth a lot of money, or your contract be worth more money, it's probably a bad idea. So just from a business and athletic point of view, I would say it's a bad idea, but I have to support his right to say what he believes.
Sullivan pointed out that the fans did not boo him when he came back from the memorial service, but I think the fan support of an athlete has something to do with their marketability for that team, or you know, their how much money they can earn in that market. This is so mercenary, but I'll just finish that thought. This is not the market to make that stand. But that's just a money consideration. I'm willing to believe that he feels strongly enough about the movement or Charlie Kirk or his faith that he's willing to not cash in on it, to lose maybe some market value. And you're so right, Eric. If this was somebody whose views I agreed with, I would be here championing the courage of the convictions, you know. But it's harder to do that. But I think it's the same thing.
I'm with Eric on that. Like, you got to have some consistency. So my thing would be, I hope the Cubs have consistency. If you have a player that wants to speak out on something that is opposite of what this guy wants to do, I hope you allow him that freedom to do so. But ultimately, I think part of it too is, like, baseball is less individual athlete centric than other sports are. So, I mean, if an NBA player did this and he's only five starting players, maybe you get a little more angst from people. The Cubs are a brand all in their own. And there's people that are going to root for the Cubs, not even knowing who the first baseman is or who the third baseman is or any of those things.
Yeah.
Just because the brand is just so strong. Same for the Yankees, the Dodgers. That's a lot of what baseball is the iconography, the brands, the city identity, more so than the athletes themselves. So he's in a better spot to get away with it, I think, even though he's in a pretty liberal city that is Chicago.
I think we all kind of agree. I mean, I fully support his I fully support him if he's speaking up for what he truly believes, and you know, and he should feel comfortable in doing that. And it probably will hurt him business wise, but if he's speaking from the courage of his convictions, God bless him. Now, it also makes me very sad because I'm a big Cub fan and I'm the parent of a transgender daughter. And the way the media, again, kowtowed for business purposes to Charlie Kirk's memory in the days after his terrible death was very discouraging to me. He was essentially deified, and commentators like Matthew Dowd, who pointed out the very negative things he said, were fired. Now, in the days after Charlie Kirk was killed, my daughter was accosted in a parking lot at Walmart in the near northwest suburbs by a man who chased her through a parking lot, videotaping her and saying, "Who are you going to kill next now that Charlie Kirk is dead?" So invoking Kirk's name and going after my daughter. That's a terrible thing. And I'm, while I support Matt Shaw for standing up for his convictions, he's got to wear that. And it makes me sad. It's going to be in my mind. I'm not going to root against him by any means, but it's going to be in my heart when I watch him play.
That's a terrible story. I'm really sorry that your daughter had to go through that. And again, it's been several months now, and I think evaluating Charlie Kirk's legacy away from the shock and the horror of how he was murdered is an important thing to do. That we can't allow him to become anything other than what he was in life, which was essentially a provocateur who said a lot of horrible things. And so for Shaw to be standing up for that, I mean, he's putting himself in league with that. I don't think it's a smart decision to do that with someone who is that polarizing and that controversial. I will note, though, that I was disappointed with Michael Jordan during all the years where Michael Jordan didn't take any stand on almost anything. And people would challenge him on it. And he'd say, I think what he said was
Republicans buy shoes too.
By his shoes too, and so he was being very, very neutral about that. On the other hand, it's hard to argue with the kind of financial success that he had taking that stance. But boy, that's what your story told, Steve. It's just awful.
Well, it was sad, and it just. She talked with John. John did a great interview with Lily about it, and I'm very proud of the way she handled it. And John, I don't know if your takeaway was the same as mine, but. There were about a dozen, she said, other people in the parking lot at the time this was happening. And it was over a couple-minute period, and no one came to her support. Everyone stood by and watched. And that's discouraging as well. I mean, no one knows who's got a gun anymore or anything like that. But it's just another example of the times that we are living in. You know, and for Shaw, again, I support him. He's doing what he believes in, and he should be certainly entitled to do that, but some of what the guy believes in is pretty nasty stuff. Some of what the guy whom he supported believed in was pretty nasty stuff.
Charlie Kirk, in other words, yeah.
Yeah.
When we were visiting before this podcast began, I said, I don't know that I want to talk about the city budget so much. And Brandon said, yeah, the budget is boring. And Eric suggested as much was true, too. But then when you look at some of the things that the city council has just passed, and we do, I guess, have a budget through the city council now, and the mayor said that – I'm not exactly sure how the rules work on this, Eric. The mayor said that he won't veto it, but he's not going to sign on to it either. But I believe that the city council has decided how they're going to pay their bills for another year, right?
It's kind of – it seems like bad sportsmanship, like a little Notre Dame move there, right? I am not going to play.
Oh, that's a tangent, but I hate that. I hate that. Who would they have played? USC? Was that going to be the game that Notre Dame would have played? I saw.
They just played in USC. I think they would. Oh, okay. They would have found a different opponent for them.
Pop-Tarts Bowl, right? Something like that.
Probably BYU or something like that. The basketball team
just lost to Indiana, Purdue, Fort Wayne, or something like that. The Notre Dame basketball team, and I had a Twitter notification pop up on my page that they were withdrawing from the season. I didn't know why, so I linked on it because I'm like, what could this possibly be? But of course, they were just laughing at them because the football team
felt like they should be eligible for the national championship tournament, and they didn't make the cut. And it's not a perfect way they set up that tournament. And so, rather than playing in the Pop-Tart Bowl, they said, "Skip it. We'll take our marbles and go home." And I think that's just such a shame for the kids that want to play in a bowl game. I think it's bad sportsmanship. To Eric's point. Anyway,
to get back to the mayor, what I'm saying is that I predicted in my newsletter just this morning, before Johnson's announcement, that he was going to sign the bill, sign the budget, and declare victory. That there is a lot in this bill in this budget that he wanted and he approved of. There are things he did not want, definitely, but that he was going to say, well, this has a lot of what I want in it, and politics isn't perfect, and we got to compromise, and I'm going to sign this bill, and Chicago is going to move on into 2026. Of course, he did not take that graceful tack here. He decided to do this strange sulking, I'm not going to sign it, but it's going to go into law. And he blasts the people who are in favor of the budget, saying that they're, you know, immorally betraying the poor people of Chicago. He issued an executive order that forbids them from collecting ambulance debt from people who haven't paid their ambulance bills, and which was, again, part of the alternative budget that did get passed. So I just, like, he just doesn't know how to strike the right tone, and I think he had an opportunity here to put this behind us and start looking forward. But yeah, it's an interesting budget. Let's talk about a few things.
Well, it is interesting for all the fine details. Yeah. None of these are make or break the bank amounts, but the 1,000 cuts that we'll continue to feel in Chicago will grow, right? Give us some examples.
Oh, well, the shopping bag tax is now going to be up to 15 cents. It was 7, then it was 10, now it's 15, or it's going to be 15. There's going to be a vast expansion under the new plan of video gaming with video poker, slot machine terminals being in restaurants and bars around all over the city, which the casino people, Bally's, is really upset about because they're afraid that their new casino is not going to be as profitable if people have these gambling venues in their own neighborhoods. They're selling these selling these debts, these civic debts, to private bill collectors, which is, you know, for pennies on the dollar. The reported debt in the Sun-Times, the city has owed $8.2 billion over the years, and maybe they think that about $1 billion of it is collectible, and they hope to sell that debt for $90 million. I think this is just a wild projection. And this is going to cause a lot of people who are behind on their bills to be hassled by bill collectors. And I understand why the mayor doesn't like that.
Owe money, but, right?
Yeah, you're right. And I was
listening to you guys talk earlier about this. And Eric, I take your point. And I didn't know about the ambulance fees. I think that's probably a good idea. Not everyone who hasn't paid their bill is doing it because they're destitute. A lot of people aren't paying their bill because they know the city's not going to come after them.
The mayor got elected paid his water bill. Go ahead.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, I get a speed light camera ticket. I pay it because I got a ticket for speeding. And so I don't have as much trouble going after some of these people who are just ignoring their bills or their summons.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're right about that. Certainly there are a number of people who are just deadbeats. But then there are people, I mean, ambulance fees. I know that my son had to take an ambulance from school to the hospital once, and it was, you know, it's not a huge deal, but the school kind of panicked and they took him. And the bill that we had to pay ended up being several hundred dollars. It was like maybe $500, and the overall charges were a lot more than that. Yeah. And it was one of those things where you just think, like, okay, we can afford that. We can absorb that without any trouble. There are families with $500 bill out of nowhere is real trouble. So I do understand where the mayor's coming from on that a little bit, but I think that he's playing the working class Chicagoans card up a little bit too hard, that he has to realize that there is not – I think Steve's point is a good one about there are people who just aren't paying because they don't think the city's going to come get them, and they owe that money, and that's how the city needs money to make it. So,
has anybody seen what percentage of I'm sure you haven't, because I don't know how you would know this. I wonder what, when you check out at a store and you have to admit in the city of Chicago that you are taking a plastic bag and that's a dime. I go to the Mariano's over here and it says, how many plastic bags are you going to use? And then it adds a dime for every bag that you use. Well, it's the honor system. There's nobody looking over your shoulder. And I wonder what percentage of the people say 0 or 1 and they take 5. And I wonder when it goes up to 15 cents. And Brandon, you can go first. I wonder if it goes up to 15 cents, if it's only going to increase the negative response, right? Or maybe people will be honest about it, but in fact, they're going to buy fewer bags because 15 cents is a lot. And then the city doesn't capture that revenue either. I'd be hard-pressed to believe that this is going to work.
It feels like a weird thing to depend on revenue for. It's designed as something to curtail abuses to our environment. That was originally what the incentive of doing something like that was, not to get more money or raise revenue. And so by raising it, one, you're saying to people, hey, this is more of a reason to bring your own bags. I think the key thing is I just be forgetting to bring my own bags sometimes. You're coming back from some place. Oh, grocery store's right there. I don't have a bag on me. I mean, of course, I'll just pay the 10 cents, right? But there's going to be people that skirt the rules all the time. So I'm not sure this is a perfect way. A lot of these things in this budget, they're not perfect. And even the mayor's office and others have questioned some of the projections here of what the revenue could actually be on some of this stuff. It's spotty to me. Spotty.
There's something actually I don't know about the bag tax, and that is this. Does the city keep track of, I mean, let's say you're Mariano's, they buy 100,000 bags. Do they have to count those bags and then account for them when the city comes and says, let's see your books. We want to see what these, we're going to count the bags. Because what you're talking about,
it's a line item on the receipt, 10 cents for the bag.
But what Eric's saying is that if you have 500 bags in your store and you're not producing 500 bags worth of tax, is the city going to come after you? Look into that.
If you as a customer don't report the number of bags you use, are you in effect shoplifting? Are you taking money from the store? I don't know the answer to that, and that's maybe something that I can look into in my newsletter next year, because that's a question that ought to have a pretty good answer.
Suburbs, you guys. I went to Mariano's today to get the ingredients for my green bean casserole for Christmas. Mm-hmm. I think I had 12 items, and they used 14 bags.
Yeah, I know. They do that, some of them. But you're not paying for those in Lake County.
No.
14 bags?
I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it was, there were several bags with one item in it.
Yeah, they don't care.
If I'm paying, baby, those bags are going to work.
But if it really was about pollution, about, keeping the streets free of the bags, then the perfect exercise of that tax would be that no revenue was created because nobody used the bags. But the city's not banking on that, are they, Brandon? They want you to use those bags. They want, because they're counting on the revenue from it. It's sort of like a tax on cigarettes. They say, well, this is for your health, but boy, we could sure use the money. What is it, guys?
Or speed cameras, too. Same thing. Oh, this is all for safety, but we do need the money.
Eric, on the radio, you and I also mentioned that you don't like the idea of slots at the airports, right? I mean, that's also something that's going – isn't that going to happen as a result of this budget?
It looks like it, yeah. And it's just a shabby look. If you've been to the airports in, like, Reno and Vegas and places where they've got them, it's like – you feel like you're in a roadside casino somewhere, and it's just not a good look. Again, I'm not morally opposed to gambling. I just don't think it's a great idea for anyone to get involved in. It creates addictions. It drains money that could be going to restaurants and theaters and retail establishments. Instead, it's going right into the pockets of these gambling interests. I think there's a problem with trying to raise a lot of money this way. Plus, the Bally's casino may end up being a bust because everyone can gamble on the street corner. So,
well, it takes money away from the businesses and stores if you lose, Eric. I mean, if I walk out with a big win, I'm going to eat a fancy steak.
Okay, well, I stand corrected.
Like a lot of the things they're counting on are things that I can avoid as a citizen of Chicago. Like, I don't game. I'll bring my canvas bag. I don't smoke. I drink alcohol. Maybe I can moderate my drinking, or maybe I'll agree to pay that. But, some of these things you can avoid.
Well, John, also you can buy your alcohol out in Ottawa and put it in your U-Haul to bring it back to Chicago.
It would be less. Okay, so I'm going to leave it at that, guys.
We could talk about how corrupt the Michigan football program is if Eric wants to.
We're out of time. Yeah. It seems like we're just out of time.
That's a tragedy. I mean, that story is just amazing. I haven't followed it closely, and I'm no big fan of Michigan, but I mean, this guy had it, and it's just almost Shakespearean. I don't know.
It's self-inflicted, that's for sure. Well, let's do this. On the next podcast, and Steve, I don't know if you're going to be able to join us next week, but you've got a standing invitation now. We'll touch on more of these things that the president has put into the atmosphere. And then I also want to read a letter from one of our listeners who I thought thoughtfully sent me a note and said that she's not going to listen to this podcast anymore. I think she does. I think she is today because I did respond to her and I told her that I wanted to bring it up and I didn't literally bring her letter in and we're out of time today anyway. So I'll share it with you guys next time. But she said that it would be nice. It would be better. It would be better if you acknowledge some of the positive things, the constructive things the president has done. And
did you send suggestions?
Or? I couldn't think of any. But if I put my nose to it, I can. And I do have a list. And I don't know if we have an obligation to, when we're criticizing the administration or finding fault with some of the things that the president has said or done, if we should, quote unquote, balance it with, well, drug costs may well go down in this country. And that was the president using the bully pulpit. Why are you smiling, Steve?
Well, because 40 years ago, remember Alan Simpson, the Republican senator, the curmudgeon? Do you remember him? Anyone?
Sure. Yeah.
Alan Simpson?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was watching him speak on C-SPAN to the young Republicans, and he said something that has always stuck with me. He said, you know, the journalism media has this whacked out view of what fairness is. He said there could be a vote in the Senate that's 99-1 and the media goes to the one person and gives them just as much play as the 99 with the idea that that's fairness, which is really a good thing to think about. And that made me, that occurred to me, John, when you were talking about that. But I agree. If there are successes or things that are positives, I do think we should. I don't know that they deserve equal weight, but I definitely think they deserve discussion.
Yeah. Next week, let's devote the entire show to how good it is that we got rid of the penny.
Well, it did cost.
I'm all behind that.
All right, guys, we're out of time. Brandon Pope, thanks for joining us. Eric Zorn. Hey, Steve Bertrand's back in the house.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop. Oh, and Neil Fisher was our producer today. Neil, nice to see you on the other side of the glass. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
Next Tuesday.
Yeah, it'll be next Tuesday, another very special pre-holiday edition of The Rascals next week.
Right, because our panel is so selfish that they want to spend Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve with their families.
You know, with this
priorities out of
the president has declared that the 24th and 26th are federal holidays, something Barack Obama did once too. He said, let's make it a four-day weekend when Christmas fell on a Thursday, but I'm all for making the 24th and 26th days off, paid days off.
Was he wearing a tan suit when he did it?
Don't say that. So there's another positive thing the president has done for us. Okay, guys, that's it this week. Talk to you later.
Thanks. Good to see everybody.
Good to meet you.
Happy holidays.
Merry Christmas.
Doodles.
Bye.
See y'all.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.